Hello and welcome to Cinepile. From the new releases to the titles that are off the beaten path, join us as we discuss and explore the art of filmmaking. You're listening to Cinepile. Let's start the show. All right, it is time to talk about our recommendations, and we're going to go around the table, but we're going to start with Neil. Neil, what do you recommend for this week?
So I'm keeping it a little modern. It's currently out in theaters right now. It's called Swiss Army Man. So if you haven't heard of Swiss Army Man, this is the film that stars Paul Dano and Daniel Radcliffe, and it's just absolutely bizarre. It's the premise is essentially Paul Dano is stuck on a desert island. We don't have any context, and he's about to kill himself because he has no hope. But he discovers a dead body that washes ashore, which is Daniel Radcliffe, and this body has special powers of flatulence that gives him the ability to jet ski his way off of the island. And that's the setup for the film.
Yeah,
I don't want to talk too much about it past that, but...
Well, and that was exciting to see that, because I know in the trailer, like, I thought they were giving away, like, such a huge part, but really that takes place in the first, like...
It's like the first
4 minutes of the film, which it takes... How quickly they introduce you into this universe of, like, this can happen, and how quickly you accept it just because it's fun is done with a fart. And I think that's brilliant in such a stupid kind of way. Because the more and more it went on, the more and more everyone just started laughing in the theater and laughing in the theater. And we all became seven-year-olds. It was hilarious. And I love that. And just that everyone just kind of like just started bubbling up with farts.
And it's acted extremely well. Mm-hmm. Paul Dano and Daniel Radcliffe do a very good job. And they kind of help you fall into this world like seamlessly. They're like, if they weren't in this film, I'm not sure how well this would have done.
Yeah,
but the fact that they pulled it off, and so by the way, this is there was a lot of Daniels, a lot of Dans on this shoot, because the directors are the Daniels, two friends, both named Daniel. They had Daniel Radcliffe, and then they had Paul Dano. Just a lot of Dans. But the directors are the same guys that did they're known for music videos. They did the Turn Down for What is probably I guess that's pretty much their most famous one. With the I don't know. I'm sure you guys have seen it. If you haven't, look it up.
I've seen it. We'll put that link in the description below.
Yeah, it's out there, and you can definitely see that style in Swiss Army Man.
I'm really excited to see it. From what I saw, just of the advertising, it was like Americans finally took on magical realism, and of course, it ended up with fart jokes.
Yeah. Well. I think someone out of the theater, I heard someone saying that, and actually I think they're kind of right, but the movie is kind of a blend between Weekend at Bernie's and The Revenant.
Yeah.
And I'll add on to that Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Yeah, Beasts of the Southern Wild for sure. It had like,
it's charming in a really weird way.
It was refreshing, I think, and so much of the imagination that Paul Dano's character, he kind of is like this unappreciated but very creative, very smart kind of guy who just didn't know how to get himself out essentially in life and be appreciated, and he's just internalized all this greatness, and then you get to see it, and it kind of gets to continually unfold, and so you get to kind of fall in love with Paul Dano's character, and
you know he's going mad, you
right
know,
like, and he's going kind of crazy, but and then also Daniel Radcliffe acts as a sounding board for his own sorrow because it's a dead body that that does random special shit stuff, so it's not really that consequential for him, and so you get to kind of get a little bit of like a peppering of what his past life included, and also at the same time they explore like silly social conventions and stuff like that about like
very much
masturbation and farting and the things that you say and people kind of cringe about and they don't have typical daily discussions about, and they say why? And that's kind of a fun thing to explore. And so you could call it, crudity, but I thought it was very, very well portrayed and a fun, veiled in comedy and also a lot of tones of seriousness. So I could understand why that's a great recommendation for you.
And just one more thing to add on, not really about the story, but something I saw. So in the opening credits, it was like a film in conjunction with Company 3. So Company 3 is a big post studio, really known for color. So I kind of looked into it. The colorist, her name is... I can't remember her name, actually. It's Sophia something. But she also did the color for Nightcrawler. And she's a commercial colorist. She does a lot of really good commercials, but she also did Nightcrawler. So thought that was interesting.
And Nightcrawler had some beautiful color. And yeah,
that was another one of our recommendations at some point, I think. Well, I'm going to go ahead and jump into my recommendation.
What you got?
Take it away, Kyle.
This film holds a special place in my heart. It's Traffic from Steven Soderbergh.
Mm.
It's, in my opinion, his best work. It's kind of like the Pulp Fiction for me in that, like, I never think Tarantino will make a better movie than Pulp Fiction. Traffic is that for Steven Soderbergh.
And yeah.
As a kid, I saw this movie, and it was one of the first films where I actually noticed and started to understand the way cinematography could help a story. And so the film has three different storylines going on. And for each one, it's all shot on 35 millimeter. He uses a different stock as well as different processing for the film.
Oh, yeah.
And so in DC, he just lets everything go blue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredible. He just lets the daylight go blue. The white balance is, they do not color time the film. And yeah, it's just marvelous. Every single section has a different feel to it. And so in Mexico with Benicio del Toro, they use a bunch of what's called, I think it was tobacco filters, to make everything appear burnt and orange and brown. And it's just the way I always imagine Mexico now.
Well, did that set the tone for the color correction? Because, I mean, you look at things like Breaking Bad, Sicarios, and several other films that whenever they go into Latin America or into Mexico, it does have that tobacco kind of burnt look. Was that before? I mean, that's kind of a random question, but I mean, I wonder if that kind of set the style or the...
I don't know. You know, it had a really documentary feel to it, and it felt real. I can definitely see it influencing the way Mexico is depicted in Latin America and all these things. I know Sicario was really heavily influenced by a photographer who used a lot of, like, beige. It was a lot of...
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the film's a little desaturated at times.
Yeah, I could say beige.
Whereas this one is like, oh my gosh, every frame is just bursting with these specific colors. Well, whether it's like the blue in DC or that orange, yellow, like sunburnt look in Mexico. And then the third story uses, oh, I can't remember. It has a proper color balance. It's a proper white balance. But they then include a whole bunch of these different filters to try to make it. It's this peaceful suburban world. And so I'm going on and on about the cinematography, but don't let that distract you. The story is amazing. It's so compelling. I absolutely love and recommend the film.
And to kind of talk about what you just talked about and the fact of color telling a story and cinematography telling a story, there's a website that I've checked out before. It's on Tumblr. It's moviebarcode.tumblr.com. And it's really cool in the fact that they take every single shot and then they essentially stretch it out vertically. And then they stack all the shots. You can look at my computer for it. And you can see the color palette and how it changes over the entire course of the whole film, which I think is something that's... I like to show it to people who don't understand the importance of color correcting or the importance of just the style and look of a film. But then you can look at, okay, here is The Social Network. Here is Harry Potter. Here is this. And it's like, oh, there was a tonal shift from blue to purple to red in the third act when this and this and this happened. And it just like, I honestly would like to print those. I think they're really cool.
Yeah, they're but, like little pieces of art.
It's a little map.
Yeah, if you just Google movie barcode, it pops up at the very top.
I wonder if they have traffic in there, because you would probably see some really
we can check that out.
Delineations they do between have prints. Different chapters.
I'll put movie barcode also in the information descriptor below if anyone is curious to check that out. But is that all you have to say about traffic?
No. Yeah, I could go on and on all day, but what's your recommendation?
I was like, okay, keep going on. My recommendation would be Gangs of New York by Martin Scorsese. The leading role is by Academy Award winner, finally, Leonardo DiCaprio and Cameron Diaz. This Sunday. No, so as Martin Scorsese goes, of course, this is going to take place in New York, as you could probably guess by the title. And it takes place in a Revolutionary War America, in that there are two rival gangs that essentially are foreigners and natives, kind of a little bit modern with today with Donald Trump a little bit, to where the natives hate the immigrants, even though they feel as though that they are somehow born out of America, even though a generation ago they were immigrants themselves. And this creates a rival gang between the Dead Rabbits, Leonardo DiCaprio, and then also the Natives, which is done by Daniel Day-Lewis as his character, Bill Cutting. And there's a huge clash, which I don't want to give anything away there. You can just watch it. Smart. Something happens in that clash. And later on, when Leonardo DiCaprio grows up, as he's a boy, when that first clash occurs, he seeks out Bill Cutting, Daniel Day-Lewis, in a plot of revenge, in which case he just has to go... What's that?
That's really what this is.
It's a revenge story. And I mean, but it's also... It follows in the lines of the Americana, a man can become anything, rising up through the ranks, going from escaping a sanatorium or escaping a religious institution, which is where Leonardo DiCaprio was. He was raised the entire time in a church. And then one of the final scenes is actually him throwing a Bible. Well, not one of the final scenes, but one of the scenes of him leaving is him throwing a Bible into the water, which is just, you know, it really sets the tone for the rest of the film, towards like, this is a film about blasphemy, about the underworld, about revenge. It's a place where God doesn't look, because they exist in this place called the Five Points, which is nothing but criminals, rapists, murderers, kingpins who run everything with corruption, with the mayor of New York, Mr. Tammany, and vote Tammany. And a great variety of things. So you get to have a great historical background, because it is all very accurate. Bill Cutting was a real guy. Tammany was a real guy. All these things were all real. So it's actually really fun to have a laptop up and randomly look up Wikipedia stuff about the Black Joke gang that ran the firefighter brigade, that also had rival fights with other firefighter brigades when things weren't standardized or controlled through the state at all. And ultimately, it's a fun adventure for both seeing where the actors go, and also a historical adventure at the same time. It is about 3 hours long, because it is Martin Scorsese, but at the same time, I think it's 3 hours well spent. So I'd definitely say watch Gangs of the New York. I'd say it's definitely in the upper sixes, near seven for me, as far as a film. On the Anderson scale of 1 through 10. But as far as our recommendations go, that's me concluding my little tidbit there. But for the rest of it, Kyle, we were going to be talking about Memories of Murder and a particular director. And
Bong Joon-ho.
I didn't want to try to say his name.
Memories of Murder, The Host, was his biggest release thus far. Mm-hmm. It was his biggest release until Snowpiercer,
yeah.
And then Mother. So yeah, The Host, Memories of Murder, Mother, Snowpiercer. He's got a new big budget one coming up with a star-studded cast. But I think the two that we were most drawn to as filmgoers were Memories of Murder and Mother.
Yep.
They're definitely, they have great production value, but they're not monster movies. They're crime films. Mm-hmm. Or at their heart, they're like, I don't even know. They both take place in a small town.
Yeah.
Small town, South Korea.
And yeah, these films are so many different things at once. It's really impressive. I don't think I was going into these expecting to be this impressed.
Yeah, he's good. He's a good director. I mean, obviously one of the main things you see after watching his films is his blocking.
Yeah.
His blocking.
Staging of actors and whatnot.
Yeah, his actors. Just the cinematography, like angles of, you know, cinematography and how they're setting up set design. And
it all feels very real.
Yes. And a lot of that has to do with, yeah, he's got a lot of long one takes that don't cut superficially, mm-hmm. just back and forth with tight.
Yeah,
tight.
It's not coverage.
Which there's an art to that, but then there's a rarer art of not doing that, of, hey, let's just get this all in one master, but we're going to make this master epic.
And meaningful,
yeah. Like,
it's so difficult to make that seem real to me.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at it as a filmmaker, as somebody who's tried to block actors,
mm-hmm.
just thinking about blocking those scenes with meaning,
yeah.
and keeping six different characters, six different viewpoints of the world in order in your head when you're trying to make all of them believable
for the scene.
It's super impressive. I was like, it did not seem like the second feature film of an auteur.
Memories of Murder? Yeah.
Yeah, it did not feel like that at all. It felt like someone really experienced. And the film we keep coming back to compare it to is Prisoners, which we're all huge fans of here.
Yes.
Yeah, it has that nice slow burn quality. Which I'm quality.
Sure we've talked about. Haven't we talked about
Prisoners? We've talked about Prisoners a little bit. I would love to dedicate an entire show to Prisoners.
Maybe someone someone might have recommended it.
Well, I think we talked about it a little bit in the Sicario episode.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure we did. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we did as far as color and everything like that. And I think also when we talked about the environment of Prisoners interacting, mm-hmm. I think you talked about that a little bit.
The environment of this, of Memories of Murder, plays a big role as well.
Yep. It's very textured. And not like, well, you know, Mother had a lot of texture with, I was going to say, like rain and stuff. They did a lot of, well, so did Memories of Murder. Rain was a huge rain part
was the
of,
whole.
So he does have a lot of texture, but I was thinking when saying that was like texture with actors.
Yeah.
And you know, the shot is a conversation of, you know, like two detectives in the police station, but in the background you got like a cell full of inmates or whatever that are also having a conversation. It's completely not part of the scene, mm-hmm. but it adds this depth of like realism.
Yes.
And it sounds simple, but it's done in a way that's very...
Well, in my mind, that's what separates cinema from television.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of photography rules, and I strive to follow them when I take my own photos. And one of them is you should always have three points of focus, especially for something like a landscape. You got your foreground, your middle, and your background.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie always had that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you've got your foreground action, you've got these things going on, you've got your setting, whether it's this room, because we film things kind of, they film things kind of wide.
Yeah.
But then you've also got a third point of focus, something that your eyes can be drawn to.
And very often, I think one of the great points of the ensemble is when they are all at the, when they're all cooking their meat and they're all sitting at the table. And there's that one guy who tumbles out of the one back room.
Oh, yeah.
That one part. So I think that's really notable as far as how their ensemble blocking is, because if you notice that they keep it a little wide, and you can actually see into the depth of the restaurant on the left side of the frame, and you can actually see people also dining, you know, very far. So following the exact same thing that you're talking about, that there's always that environmental tone that's given into all the ensemble. But it also reminded me very much so of stage acting. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, stage actors, they can't just run off screen because they're going to have a line in a little bit, and so they have to be occupied. And so I'm curious what Bong Ho's experience is as far as, like, is he a big theater goer? I know that the Asian culture, they're very into, like, large stage acting, and that's actually a very active part of their culture, not so much in America. I think we should all watch some stage acting. I think that'd be good for us. But... yeah. I'm curious what that is a background of his, or as far as his education, that you have to understand staging of an actual physical stage as far as theater goes, and then also a cinematic staging. Because I know that the schooling compared to America, and I know European, is that they have to know things about architecture, they have to know things about more advanced ideas about lighting and also art and so on and so forth. So it allows you to think in a more dynamic and broader way. So I'm curious what the Asian schools methodology of teaching is, because it definitely comes off unique, or I would say it also comes off as you have these modern conventions that he does as far as his cinematography and his style and look, but at the same time when you look at old 50s films like Maltese Falcon and things like that, you know, big awesome films that we love, they very often didn't get to move the cameras often, so they had the people move to the camera.
Yeah,
and so often that was what was going on, to where, you know, you'd have some guy fiddling in the background doing something, lighting a cigar, and then he'll pipe up later on, but it doesn't feel like a false blocking, like the Avengers. The Avengers has that kind of ensemble blocking, but with lots of coverage, with lots of camera movement, and with actors not staying in front of each other. Everybody's got their face, you know, cheated out just so perfectly so everyone has screen time. Whereas this, I mean, like we've seen, you'll see the back of somebody's head, and that's a part of the frame. And
well, I think just another idea I was having is like a big like part of my editing style when I did like a lot of editing was to almost manufacture a scene. Like I can piece together shots that weren't necessarily relevant with each other and time it in a way it's like, oh, this happened within the scene. He doesn't have to do that, and it comes off a lot more genuine because he actually just shoots the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having like, okay, we need a shot of him grabbing something. Okay, we need a shot of him looking up at his partner.
Yeah.
Okay, now we need a shot of his partner, you know, nodding. I'll piece it together and make it seem like it happened in one flow. But it's a lot better when you don't have to do that, when it is just real. You just have it in the master.
Yeah. Well, I think also in the fact that it's a criminal, and it's about conversations, and it's about drama, So really, you don't have to worry about the grabbing of one object. You don't have to worry about like this kind of thing that, you know, the lens in American films follow so often. It's about just a conversation. And I think that's why you get to have that ensemble convention happening so often in this movie. And I think it really just allows it to carry it very well. And I don't know, it's great. I loved it.
Hitchcock had a rule, and I think it's something we ignore a lot nowadays. And I'm coming back to, I guess, the difference between, in my mind, television and cinema. And the rule was the size of something in the frame tells you its significance to the story. Not just to the plot, but to the story itself. If you're going to put a close-up, as they do in Memories of Murder, they move much closer towards the end when you're actually coming to the climax of these characters' journey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's because it's important for you to be looking at their face. If there's an object that's in close-up, like in Dial M for Murder, the telephone is in this huge, grotesque close-up in front of the frame. It tells you how important it is to the story instead of just looking good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of television...
It's like, oh, this shot looks good.
Yeah.
Put it in.
A lot of television, it's like almost like a wedding video. Where it's like, all right, well, we're going to open, we're going to have the close-up of the flowers. We're going to have the close-up of this over here, and then we'll... You know, but what is really important to the story
yeah.
at that point?
I love Hitchcock to shoot a wedding video. What you don't realize is there's a bomb underneath both the bride and groom's table. This will build all kinds of tension.
Well, and for sure, Bong Joon-ho uses that, because in a lot of his scenes, even if it's a master, yeah, it's like, who's your attention drawn to? Mm-hmm. It's specifically drawn to what is important.
Yeah.
So he naturally makes it so you see what's important. Whether he'd be bigger in the shot, like when they're doing the interrogation scenes.
Yeah, whether someone...
Where it's like the someone that, you know, the person that's under the light looking, but he's got, you know, all his buddies and detectives behind him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the important one.
Right.
Yeah, just like simple...
mise-en-scene of people. Really.
He doesn't cut to a close-up of him for that moment because they want you to look at him. Yeah. They don't need to do that. They can just... have the stage in a way that you're already going to look at him, and now you have all the texture of everything else happening. And it just seems much more real.
Yeah, much more authentic for sure.
The whole movie feels really genuine to me, and I think it's a beautiful film for us, for anybody to really look, if they're interested in making movies, to look at that. And you can really draw so many things from it. You know, the police procedural, the way you treat characters. We were talking earlier, and I'd like to talk about it now maybe, how all of his characters are flawed, mm-hmm. and he's not trying to make movies about superheroes. There's no super detective to come in and save the day.
Right.
Like, I love Prisoners to Death, but looking back, comparing these two films, Prisoners has a lot of the kind of hokey mm-hmm. American plot points that
the specialist comes in.
Yeah, this film doesn't have.
Yeah.
Well, what's funny is the specialist does come in, and he's just as lost as the local stupid cop who is corrupt and who is just...
Over time, though.
Yeah, over time. I mean, of course, at the beginning, he's reading documents and he's smart and he's drawing up charts and, like, you know, doing a kind of a serial killer profile and making it very, very intelligent. But then eventually, he's, you know, completely feckless in anything that he can do against this serial killer.
Yeah, he's powerless no matter how smart he is. It doesn't mean it's just going to work out for him. It feels more like the real world than a lot of other crime films you've seen. I'm kind of more reminded of Zodiac in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Zodiac was almost 100% like to real life. You know, they took a lot of pains to be like, this is what happened. This is what happened. It did not just give the audience what they want. They give them what happened.
Yeah, it wasn't based off of excitement. Like you said, it's a procedural. You're watching what would happen step by step. Oh, this didn't lead to anything? That's what happens when you're solving a crime. There are dead ends. Now we're going to jump all the way back and let's go and try to go through this end. But it's exciting at the same time because it's just like when you're trying to figure something out, okay, we're one step closer potentially. And so I think over time, it rises the tension as far as mm-hmm. finding who could be behind this.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, harkening back to the Prisoners, it's very, very focused. And it's like, okay, this is where we're looking. Whereas you adopt all the same traits that the investigators have from frustration looking at this cloud and just wondering who is behind it, that you have no clue. There's no guessing in it, and that's very true to life. And I think that's what made the movie so exciting. And when we were even talking to each other, like, going, like, who do you think did it? Like, is that guy or blah, blah, blah? And then they'll give you red herrings. They'll give you these, like, fun little things. It's, like, it's playful and it's interesting.
And then also they have the development of the detectives and the characters that you know, you get latched onto. It was like, the specialist dramas. From Seoul comes into this small town to take over this case, essentially. You know, clearly, without telling you, you can tell that this guy is the man.
Yeah,
he's smart. He solves probably all of his cases. Something, you know, like something ridiculous, I bet.
Right.
Yeah. And he comes to this, and he starts out strong, and over time, he starts to kind of look just as bad as the fools or the buffoon like detectives that are from the town. Because he's getting more and more frustrated and more desperate to try to find. You know, he's probably not comfortable or used to anything like this. And so you kind of see this like digression of these characters, all the while you have, here's new evidence, here's new hints and stuff. And so, it's like you have multiple avenues of excitement.
You mentioned the rain earlier, and I think this was such a brilliant piece, is that often the serial killer chooses to pick off his victims when it rains to help him get rid of the evidence.
Only when it rains, right?
Only when it rains.
Yeah.
There's not a single one.
No, I don't.
Well, like, we don't need to talk about it too much, but that's the major plot point is when it rains.
Yes, he actually did, during rain.
Yeah, the rain plays a big part, is what I'm getting
at. Yeah, wash away the evidence.
It helps him wash away that evidence. Right. And so you start seeing the rain dripping outside.
Yeah,
and you just know that time's running out.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in this town, this guy's going to try to strike, and they can't be in every place at once. There's just gigantic amounts of tension in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this isn't like a cat and mouse kind of thing either. You know, it's not like we're in the fog of war on this.
Yeah.
You know, all we see is the evidence afterwards. We don't have like, oh, someone's, you know, one step ahead of them. Mm-hmm. It's not that someone's a step ahead of them. It's that they just can't find it. They can't figure anything out. Yeah. You know?
Well, the funny thing was, like, let's say this was an American film, for sure there would be a big TV, and they would look at it, and you would see like this inclement storm coming in, and they'd probably do parallel cuts back and forth about the storm coming in. Like, we only have 1 hour before the storm hits. The killer's gonna strike. We need to hurry.
Yeah.
And just like this, blah 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 blah. But that, I think that was also fun, is that they didn't, you know, pander in that kind of respect. The rain just kind of happened, and it was just like you would hear a thunderclap, and it was just like, oh no. And then even the, actually I won't leave that, but there's another piece of evidence that gets unveiled, which is also really hearkening to the person going to go out and kill someone.
Right.
So it has this fun like man versus man versus nature kind of aspect, in that they are coalescing as a killer, and it's like this double enemy that you're having to deal with. But that's cool. Like, I like how they brought in that environmental aspect. There's actually a great video game called Heavy Rain about a serial killer, but he drowns his victims with the rainy period. So like, he like locks them in a particular room, and they just go up to a grate and they just drown. And so like, whenever there's a heavy, heavy rainy period, that there's a person who drowns. You'd love it. I think you'd really enjoy the game. It's made by the same people, I think, who made Last of Us, I want to say.
Wait, is that Naughty Dog?
I think so. I don't know. You'll like it. But as far as just cinema and video games, they definitely meet.
Interesting. Cool.
Strong point of it. But do we want to talk more about Memories of Murder, or do we want to talk about other Bong Ho films?
Well, let's
we haven't even mentioned Mother.
Really. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's bring in Sakai. You.
Wait, did it say Memories of Mother? Memories of Murder.
Memories of Mother. Kyle, you were bringing up earlier about like the Village Fool, and kind of like what that, you know, how that plays into both Memories of Murder and Mother. Obviously huge in Mother.
Absolutely huge in Mother. So just a really quick plot synopsis for Mother. The protagonist is an old mother who lives with her retarded, I think he's like 26-year-old son, and the son is arrested for a murder. And this mother, this cute little Asian old Asian
woman. Runs a little herb shop.
Yeah, who runs like an illegal acupuncture shop. Is running around running around town trying to prove her retarded son's innocence.
Yeah.
And so he is the village fool in this one. And not in like the Shakespearean one where they're all clever and all this. It's like every small town, kind of like To Kill a Mockingbird, has that village fool.
The
retarded kid of the town who everyone either kind of like puts up with or looks after. It's like, it's that kind of dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I like the small town dynamic he has going here. But he actually brings them in both films into the plot in a big way.
In a very big way, yeah. So, and in actually in a very similar way.
Which also deals with memory.
Yeah.
And
so in Memories of Murder, there's a retarded boy who had followed one of the victims. And so he becomes a suspect, for sure.
Yes.
And I don't want to tell you whether he did it or not in that one, but it's like immediately people are going to think that maybe, I don't know if he's actually trying to say something about our preconceived notions about retarded people or anything like that, how we maybe are a little worried about them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe so. I mean, there is like that kind of natural fear because there's that unpredictability, but at the same time, they can't defend themselves. So maybe it's more so saying that society will eat the defenseless.
Well, that's, I think it has both dynamics in Memories of Murder for sure, because the cops that are interrogating him are the kind of crooked, and I say crooked, they seemed good intentioned.
They're more crooked than ampersand, let's just say that.
Well, they're good intentioned and they're trying to like actually get to it, but they're lazy is almost the word, where they're like cutting corners, you know, they're literally planting evidence against this retarded kid to try to get him to say a confession because they think he did it.
Making him dig his own grave. It's like some Inquisition kind of level of police work done by them.
So I'm sure a lot of our listeners and people just in general have seen Making a Murderer and been so frustrated by the way that the police abuse people of low IQ.
Yeah.
What was another? There was another true crime series that did that recently, where it's a motif throughout all of these police series, these documentaries, abusing and getting testimony from the inept.
Right.
Well, and one thing that definitely is a common thread as well is the misunderstanding. Because, I mean, let's just say something like that happened in Dallas and it was a mentally challenged person. I mean, granted, there has been prosecutions of individuals with mentally challenged issues, but let's say someone at the same convention that Memories of Murder was, that because we are more so a city with more so educated people that are a bit more serious about their prosecution and not so jump quick to lay down a guilty plea, that we would actually follow through and be like, no, this person would not have the capability to do it because we have an educated understanding of the mentally challenged. Whereas if you look at the rural kind of thing towards like, okay, this person was never really officially diagnosed as mentally challenged or never was really cared for and got to operate in conventions of that. And then also people can just sling out whatever they want with no one of really any stature or intellect because of corruption, that anyone who is of stature of intellect is corrupt because of this small microcosm that's created by a rural town. And so it's like these microcosms that allow this kind of abuse to take place, that maybe that's what not that necessarily the director was addressing, but something that, you know, like within Making a Murderer definitely seems to have a common thread that, you know, not to say that all rural people are like that, but
of course
not. It makes sense that would be a place where it would occur.
Yeah.
So the backdrop makes sense.
And it plays a really big role in Mother, for sure.
Yes.
You could almost call it a red herring in Memories, but there are still so many questions about what actually occurred in Memories.
Well, and there's the really damning confession
in
Memories. That,
oh my gosh. Yeah. So, but that's drama right there.
Yeah.
It's immediately dramatic. And I really like that he has these characters play large roles in the story. And I don't want to call all the other characters stupid, but nobody is this bright, shining star. They all do like these weird... there's an odd sense of humor that goes in both of these movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it's physical. Like as simple as somebody falling down an embankment into a crime scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or just some random farmer driving over the footprint.
Yeah.
Like...
yeah. It's like this comedy of errors where it's like, oh, they don't even know how to handle a crime scene. It's just a small town.
Well, it's like South Korea. Not FBI specialist, but the specialist who comes from Seoul gets arrested by the local cop because he thinks he's trying to rape
Rape a woman, yeah.
And that's just like, yep, that's how you met.
Which was almost like, even though it's dark, it was almost like a slapstick, like wrong place, wrong time, like just perfect timing of,
yeah.
Like, well, this guy we saw wasn't doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah. It's good.
Definitely explores like the fun kind of things for what you get to see and what you don't get to see, and plays with you in that aspect for sure.
Well, another thing that we don't need to get too deep on because it's just a quick thought, but the two fools in these two movies both have violent acts revealed happen to them by someone very close to them.
Right.
So either attempted murder, maybe because it was something that's like, oh, this is a shame to like a family or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and that both of the characters had violence against them,
basically abused in some way.
More than abused, though. Yeah, you know, like very malicious.
And I think that also kind of probably holds a little bit of
that
society can harm those who can't speak for themselves, and then will also accuse those who can't speak for themselves. So it's like this person is just because they are so defenseless, like of this horrific and true violence, they are the most innocent and are the first ones to take on any kind of blame.
And that's so sad.
It's horribly sad. Yeah. It's a tragedy in its own right, but I think that's what makes the movie good, is that it is very true to life and it has that tragedy, drama, revenge, you know, every single plot point that you would imagine would go along with something of such a high caliber crime and the investigation of it.
Yeah, so I think it also, in that treatment of, I'm just going to call them the fool,
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
this kind of archetype, it's honest. He doesn't gloss over any of the abuses or what being a retard living in a small town like this would actually entail. But so it also allows you to laugh with them in the same way that you laugh at the person who falls down the embankment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not, I think a lesser film would use them only as comic relief.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They would be like a little piece that they're moving around the board.
Yeah.
But for these two movies, they're so real. You know, their problems are real. And you can laugh with them instead mm-hmm. of just at them.
Right.
Right.
And you feel for them.
I think maybe the revealing of the violence to them for sure helps a viewer get that point of view as well. Where mm-hmm. it really hits home. It's like, this is a human being right here. I might have been looking at this just as a fool or something. But no, this is a human being with problems. You relate to them much more.
Yeah, maybe at first you're just laughing with them or you're feeling sorry for them because of the way the police are treating them. But it's just like, he really brings it home.
Like Hodor.
Both of these movies. Like Hodor?
Like Hodor.
Willis.
Willis, yeah. William. Willis, William.
Oh, yeah. I feel like we could rave about these movies all day.
For
hope he goes back to something like this. Granted, I'm excited for his next movie, Okja.
This is another discussion we should be having about him because, yeah, he's kind of got this blend now of American and Korean,
mm-hmm.
both actors and kind of styles. So, I don't know if we could talk about Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer is this huge international effort. It did way better with viewers like us than mm-hmm. I think it did in its theatrical. I could go look up the real numbers later.
The sheeple.
The sheeple.
Those that don't have a highbrow cinema.
So what do you got? You got a French graphic novel,
mm-hmm.
a South Korean director, and a mixed American, English, South Korean cast.
Stars, too. Yeah,
yeah, like big stars.
Starring Captain America.
Chris Evans, Captain America, and Tilda Swinton are probably the two big ones.
Yeah, for sure.
I only saw the film once, and it spurred this huge debate between my roommate and I about the moral decisions in the film.
Sure.
So even though I'm not in love with the movie, I love that it brought up a lot of conversation in the same way that Memories and Mother did.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, it's a lot about morality, I think.
It's hard to compare it to Memories and Mother.
Yeah,
they're so radically different.
Right.
But at the same time, there are lots of ensemble acting that does, you know, take place. Shake forth and herewith.
Like the big, yeah, the big, just yeah, the overarching example is the left, the right.
Yeah, exactly.
Like nature of the film.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's all like Das Boot, or you know, it's, yeah, it's all oh, like,
yeah, it does
all
have a
going from one direction to the other. It doesn't ever like flip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love it because it is a, it literally has to be a linear film. To where it's like we're trying to go from the back of the train to the front of the train.
Yeah,
and the.
Wait, who was at the head of the train again? Who was that?
It was Ed Harris.
Ed Harris.
And, like,
right.
Whoever, just to kind of give a quick synopsis of it, essentially the world has gone into an ice ball in a way of fighting global warming. And so there's one train that was made by this super genius that is the last remnant that we know of mankind. And
living
it's,
on
and
this it, train.
And it's running 500-700 miles an hour, just going around the Earth. Because it has to collect like things like water and so on and so forth, so it has to keep moving. And all these people live on it. It's all self-sustaining kind of biome, but at the same time, there is a back of the train that is just, you know, people who are poor.
Warfare.
Yeah, it's a class warfare,
yeah.
And it's about rising up of that class warfare. And you know, Chris Evans kind of helps to lead it and whatnot. But I think it also brings up some societal conventions again, as far as like, you know, this. You know, laptop I have, these clothes that I have, were they made by poor people that we had to take advantage of through trade agreements in order to get what I want so I can be happy in America as a rich person who had to have a shitty life to get my stupid laptop. You know, what kid had to sit there and mine in the aluminum fields in, like, China? And it addresses, I think, those kind of conventions on a very microcosmic
and a very surreal
again.
And it's a very surreal film.
Very, yeah, very fantasy. Well, not fantasy, but.
And I think that's where
sci-fi.
It falls a little short for me. What I appreciate so much about Mother and Memories of Murder is you're not getting beat over the head.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the entire premise of Snowpiercer is subtext.
Right.
The entire premise is
on
just,
the surface,
yeah,
it's ridiculous.
On the surface, it's absolutely ridiculous. But then you're like, okay, so this is at its very. Like, on the paper, it's a class warfare struggle.
Right.
It's each car of the train gets better and better until you're at the president, the king. And, yeah.
And he has answers for you that you maybe don't want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's subtlety in it, but much less, I think. Maybe I need to go rewatch it, but it seemed like Memories of Murder and Mother were just all about the subtleties.
Yeah.
Well, what's more exciting about Snowpiercer that you could talk about is the merge of... Because... Watching this film, it was an American film, like Chris Evans, all English, mm-hmm. But it very much felt like a Korean film.
Yeah,
like it didn't feel like a normal film that you see.
Yeah, for sure. He could have just been taken out. I feel like him just put with a Korean lead, and I would have been like, oh, this is an Asian film.
Or it could have. This or almost like could have been like an animated movie. You know, like it was just that kind of like anime, like, mm-hmm. I don't know, Asian style.
I would have loved to see that in anime. That
and that's
kind of
cool.
Movie.
So, like, now, you know, he's making his next movie, Okja. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which will, you know, we'll see what that really entails visually once we start getting some trailers and stuff.
Right.
But that, your impression really goes to the source material. So, Memories of Murder was inspired by a theatrical play about a true life serial killer, mm-hmm. in a small Korean town.
Oh, did not know that.
So it felt, the movie feels cinematic. When I say theatrical with the staging and all of these things, I don't want to imply that it feels like 2D.
Right.
Kind of like they're on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so you have a graphic novel for Snowpiercer,
yeah.
Which is basically an animated movie on
yeah.
the page.
Yeah.
And so it seems like he's being very true to the source material.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited for him.
Yeah, I'm excited to see everything that he makes in the future. And I want to really go find his very first film.
What's that?
Oh, the Barking Dogs.
Yeah, Barking Dogs Never Bite.
Well,
very, very
maybe we
movie.
Could go to Premiere Video and check that out. And in case anyone's listening to this and lives in the Dallas area, we source all of our movies from this amazing place called Premiere Video, which is just this ungodly giant library of just all things cinema.
It's like,
yeah.
What
like, where's our Russian film
Buster
section?
Really needed to do. They need
yeah.
to have, like,
everything.
People that understand film.
Yeah.
not just, like, not consumers, but prosumers
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like a prosumer market for film.
Yeah. Yeah. You can find a lot of titles. They didn't have Barking Dogs Never Bite, but the great thing about the owner is I could probably go up to him and talk to him, and he'll order it for us.
Yeah. And just be like, oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's probably like, yeah, I've seen that. It's great. You know, it seems like he knows any movie you talk to him about.
Yeah.
Or if he hasn't seen it, he knows of it. He's like, well, I heard.
I didn't know that guy was the owner.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did not know that.
Yeah.
Well, he's a cool guy. Oh, do you guys have anything to add over any of the movies that we discussed?
Just go.
I'm sure we would, but.
Yeah, if you haven't seen them, go watch them. I want to watch all of them a second time, and I think that says everything.
Okay.
About the value of these movies.
So to recap, my recommendation was Gangs of New York, Kyle.
Traffic.
Neil.
And I had Swiss Army Man.
Okay, and the other movies that we were talking about were by the director.
Bong Joon-ho.
And that was Memories of Murder, Mother, Snowpiercer, and all those will be down in the information down below. Thank you guys for listening to Cinepile. We always appreciate it. And stay tuned for the next episode.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.